You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's often said that events are what decide elections, but according to professor of political science at UC San Diego and Democratic campaign consultant Samuel L. Popkin, they're only a small part of the equation. In his latest book, The Candidate, What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House, he describes the qualities and strategies that it takes to win a presidential election. The book is published by Oxford University Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Professor Popkin to our show today. Hello.
Good morning.
You say that there are three campaigns that any candidate can run: challenger, incumbent, and successor. Why is successor the hardest of the three?
Successor is so hard because you've been in the public eye for 8 years, and you think that means you're so well known, but you're a blur. You're a cheerleader, you're a mascot, you're a lapdog, as George Will called Vice President Bush. And so people are very uncertain about what you stand for. They may see you sitting behind the president, but they're clueless.
So vice presidents trying to become presidents always have a major hurdle to overcome.
Very hard.
Now, do each of the three different kinds of campaigns require a totally different playbook?
They're very different. It's as different in football as, say, offense and defense, in the sense that, well, think of it as a battleship versus a torpedo boat. The presidency is a very large battleship. It moves slowly, but when it moves, it makes very big waves. The challenger is talking about hope and change, and your glass is half full, and you promised it to be full, and I'm going to fix it.
And that's why you say that the ideal challenger is an experienced virgin.
Yes, and I understand that's a contradiction, but it's what we want. We want somebody who's pure, unsullied, and uncompromised, yet ready to go and do it all on day one.
Now, does President Obama's incumbency give him a clear advantage? Doesn't it also give him a record that he has to defend?
Right. It's not an advantage or a disadvantage. It's a different playbook. And you nailed it exactly. Whether it's an advantage or a disadvantage depends on how well you're using the office.
Well, but also he's going to have to figure out a way to make everything that he's done look like it's worth getting him your vote again. And he has 6 months to do that. He's been under incredible attack for a while now.
Well, always when there's divided government, the president is under vicious attack. The question is, does the president look like he's the man, like Hans, the person with the finger in the dike, blocking the forces of evil and stopping the floods? Or are they the weakling who can get nothing done and you should let the other party take over?
Doesn't it also depend on how the Romney campaign launches its attacks on him?
Well,
I mean,
yes.
You can attack him effectively or you can be ineffective.
Yes, and I think that it's gotten harder and harder with all the free money floating around in the super PACs.
Do the rules for a campaign apply once you've won the election? It's been argued that President Obama's campaign team, including David Axelrod and David Plouffe, were not as good at governing as they were at campaigning.
Well, you can't be as good at having a unified message when you have the whole government as you are when you've just got a little war room.
Uh-huh. But if you have a strategy, then why can you have a winning strategy and then suddenly not be able to figure out how to have a winning strategy when you're actually in office?
Well, I think every president, including Reagan and Eisenhower, overestimates how much their own party supports them and how willing to work together the other party is. And it has, in fact, gotten harder and harder whichever party is in Congress and whichever party is in the White House.
You've been studying or working on political campaigns since 1964 as a polling and strategy consultant for the Clinton campaign and then on the Gore campaign in 2000, which you describe as dysfunctional, incoherent, and low on esprit de corps or unity. Should we be surprised then that despite those problems, Al Gore came so close to winning the presidency?
Well, close only counts in horseshoes and dancing.
Yeah, but many people think that he actually won it, and it was the Supreme Court that decided that election.
The Supreme Court did, but I would just like to say that if it was a well-managed campaign, you'd have never heard of Ched.
Well, what was the problem there? That Gore was running as a successor to Clinton. You say that's really difficult. And at the same time, he was trying to run away from Clinton in the wake of the Monica Lewinsky scandal.
Well, that's the problem. This was a Clinton blot, not a Gore blot. And deciding that the reason you're low in the polls is because of the stain of Bill Clinton, when every vice president has been low in the polls at the beginning, and not taking your time. When he decided to separate from the president the day he announced, what he did was create terrible tension between two White House staffs, confuse the campaign, and step on his own message.
Do you think that some of the organizational problems you saw in the Gore campaign were issues in Hillary Clinton's campaign?
No, I think their problems were very different.
So people didn't connect Hillary Clinton to Bill Clinton?
I don't think Bill Clinton helped or hurt her until later in the campaign when he started acting like an aggrieved spouse.
Now, you say that a strong chief of staff is a key, but Donna Brazile is a pretty strong chief of staff. She was his campaign manager. Why couldn't she get things under control?
Donna wasn't strong because Al Gore didn't let her be strong. It's not the character. Donna Brazile is a very competent person. So was Bill Daley. So was Carter Eskew. But whether you're strong or not depends on whether you're second guessed and whether you know what the president or vice president's family is telling him.
So you can put together a great campaign staff, and still if you don't give them any power to make major decisions, then it's just a waste of time.
I was stunned when I looked at all the campaigns from the Dewey Archives forward, Truman, Nixon, everybody, how often the problem is a weak chief of staff that's undermined by a freelancing candidate or not including the wife in the campaign loop.
Well, but in the case of Hillary Clinton, she was the candidate. But was her problem also a weak chief of staff?
Yes. And I don't know Patty Silas Doyle, and I'm not here to judge her overall competence. But Patty Silas Doyle had no chance to control anything because everybody who didn't like a decision would call Hillary, and Hillary might make a new decision on the spot. So why argue with Mark Penn or Mandy Grunewald or Howard Wolfson along with Patty if Patty didn't have the authority to enforce anything?
So should she have been the gatekeeper? Because every candidate is going to get a lot of ideas thrown at them. And there are a lot of smart people out there who all have wonderful ideas. And after the election, they say, well, I suggested that they do such and such, and that would have won the election for them. They didn't listen to me.
You can't possibly take all the advice, but you have to at least screen the advice and keep the family, the candidate, and the media team on the same page so they all know. Al Gore would make decisions at the last minute, and his campaign managers or media people would be surprised by some of the decisions, or he would not really thrash it out with them. He'd go off on his own.
So everything has to be done after it's been everything the candidate does has to go through a committee first?
No, it can't all go through a committee because you're on the stage sometime and something comes out of nowhere. But when you decide to take a line and you don't check with people, you may decide a joke a friend told you is the great joke and not understand that it's a joke about somebody who just died. Or you're going to mention some great restaurant in the city and not know that they just got closed for a health violation.
And this was a problem for Michelle Bachmann, who often said things that turned out to be embarrassingly off the mark.
One of the ironies of 2012 was that the old nemesis of the left, Fox News, became the nemesis of Ed Rollins and the Wall Street Journal. As Ed said one day, he said, you know, you go on Fox News, you say something really outrageous, and you raise a couple million dollars, and you think you don't need any answers.
My guest is Samuel L. Popkin. He's written a book called The Candidate, What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House. You're right, there are two winners in every presidential election campaign, the inevitable winner when it begins and the inevitable victor after it ends. How often are those two winners the same person?
Seldom.
Look, well, but President Clinton in 1996, Ronald Reagan 1984.
Well, when you look at opening, let's think about Giuliani and Clinton, the obvious winners in 2007.
Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm.
Or in 92, Bill Clinton looked like the bottom of the barrel. He looked unelectable most of the way.
And, of course, we have Thomas Dewey beating Harry Truman,
who I think was probably the most competent candidate to lose I've seen in the last 60 years.
So what went wrong for him?
Senator Taft decided it was more important to protect his standing than to let Dewey take leadership, and Taft would say, okay, my way is the past, your way is the future. And Truman gave Taft the rope to hang Dewey.
I think back to some other elections, people who are almost becoming obscure now. Edmund Muskie, Paul Tsongas, for example. He was the early favorite in 1992.
Yes, it's very often. And the ones that I mentioned earlier had the most money, the most endorsements, and the most press. So these common excuses, well, if the press had given us more coverage, or if we'd had more money, or if we'd had the poll standings or the endorsements, these guys had it all, and they still lost.
Were you surprised that in this year's Republican primary race, every single candidate, Michelle Bachmann, Herman Cain, Donald Trump, Newt Gingrich, Rick Santorum, Ron Paul, all seemed to be considered the favorite at some point or another?
I have to wonder. I'm a Jew, and until 2008, I didn't understand how many people considered Mormons a cult. I just thought it was a variant of Christianity. And I have to wonder if Mitt Romney had been a Methodist or a Baptist, if it would have been so complicated.
Well, he also, we've seen a situation where political parties have become much more polarized today. And in the past, it may not have bothered people as much as it does today in the primaries, where evangelicals, religious conservatives, social conservatives predominate in the Republican Party.
Yes, I was surprised by how fragmented things got this year. And it's going to be very difficult going forward for the party to put itself together the way the Democrats did after the Mondale election.
But here we are, Mitt Romney, who people considered to be the likely choice from the beginning, has survived. He's now is the presumptive nominee. So was all of that just people trying to find somebody else to replace Mitt when Mitt was obviously the strongest candidate?
Mitt is the lowest common denominator in the end, and it bothered people that they couldn't have more of their ideal. But the process was actually very tough on Mitt because his challengers were to the right of him, and he had to make a lot of compromises that he would have given anything to have avoided on the way to the main event.
Because the convention of wisdom is that once you win the nomination, you move to the center. That's going to be rather difficult this time, isn't it?
If you look at in 2009, the Mitt Romney of 2009 would be 5 to 8 points ahead of President Obama right now. He could say, I'm the exact same Obamacare plus economic competence and job creation of an executive.
But instead he's running away from his own record.
Yeah, he's repudiated his prime accomplishments. He's attacked contraception. I mean, he's done a million things like that.
Matt Taibbi was on our show yesterday, and he said he sees very little enthusiasm among Republicans for Mitt Romney. What role does enthusiasm play? Don't some people just vote for the candidate of their party no matter what?
Yes. It's very – every election, you try and wonder how much it matters. The thing I can say matters is looking at the CBS New York Times polls since 76 or 80 have asked, how much attention are you paying to the election? And it was very easy to see early on that 92 and 2008 were going to be big surges in turnout. It's hard to tell this year whether all the new voters of 2004 for the evangelicals or 2008 for Obama care enough this time.
Young people especially.
Yes.
For Obama.
We think it's probable that 30 to 50% of them will still vote. And there are certain things inflaming minorities about immigration and Mr. Ricketts and Brian Baker that might give Obama more turnout than he might have got otherwise.
On the other hand, there are people who might have supported Obama for all sorts of other reasons but are upset about same-sex marriage. Things tend to cancel each other out.
So I don't think it's clear that same-sex marriage helps or hurts either right now. It was clear when it happened that Obama lucked into a big gain for temporarily. I never thought I'd see the day when the Republicans attacked a Democrat for talking about social issues as a smokescreen. I mean, when Mitt Romney said gay marriage is a smokescreen, you knew that he didn't want that on the table because it was making it harder for him in states like Colorado.
My guest is Samuel L. Popkin, professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. He served as a consultant to the Carter, McGovern, Clinton, any other campaigns?
Gore.
And he's written a book called The Candidate, What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House. It is published by Oxford University Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Samuel L. Popkin. His latest book, The Candidate, What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House. It is published by Oxford University Press. I was thinking about enthusiasm before. When John McCain selected Sarah Palin as his running mate, there was an incredible outpouring of enthusiasm. And some of that remained. And then for others, of course, things changed. Ultimately, it's assumed that the selection of Sarah Palin worked against John McCain.
Absolutely. It called into question his judgment, his planning, his consistency. And, you know, there's often a bubble. The less you know, it's like the experienced virgin. You've got, you know, Superwoman from another planet coming in from Wasilla with a lot of great lines. And the one person, everybody in the Bush White House was ecstatic that day because there was finally something to be excited about because none of them liked McCain after the way he treated Bush. And W walked into a room where they were all raving about her and he said, just wait a week or two. It's a lot harder than it looks if you're not ready.
In addition to overseeing their own campaigns, candidates usually have crafted a public image, part of what we were just talking about, and a policy vision. Does a candidate have to excel at all three parts of that equation?
I don't think it's possible to be good at being the vision of America and at being the CEO and at being the visionary. But you've got to be able to do all three, and that's where your team comes in.
But you have this narrative of a candidate's public image and policy vision, and then you have this incredibly long campaign. Can they withstand the pressures of all that time?
Well, that's what made me realize. When I started the process, I always thought it was about having the best strategy or the best strategist or the best media people. And then I realized that the most wonderful line is the military line. Planning is everything. The plan is nothing. Because the minute the shooting starts, you have to start over. And it's how fast you adapt.
Well, they also say that the military tends to fight the last war. Do candidates tend to gear their campaigns to the last election?
You nailed it. It's the war they're comfortable with. If you're a senator, you think I can run the way I ran for Senate to get the nomination. If you're the president, everybody says, can Obama do again what he did in 2008? Well, no, he can't, because he's not the outsider promising to change it, the tone of Washington. He's the insider with the same toxic tone he said he would get rid of.
So will we see candidates use strategies that worked in 2008 now in 2012, even if they may not address the current political climate?
It takes a while to realize that everything you're used to doesn't fit very well. And we saw that with how slowly and poorly Hillary Clinton adapted in 2008. She thought doing Iowa would be like doing upstate New York in 2006. It's a lot harder.
But is fighting the last campaign one of the reasons that President Obama's former pastor, Reverend Wright, was considered as a weapon against the president all these years later when, we're talking about 4 years later or even 5 years later? Or should we make an important distinction between the official campaign and what a super PAC might want to do?
Let's assume it was independent. It was still stupid from my point of view, not because it was immoral or racist or nasty, but because when you're president, it's not your personality and your pre-presidential history that people are worried about. It's what you've done for the last 4 years. And so that's going like attack his childhood as opposed to the economy. It seems a little distant.
But is this an example of how the Citizens United ruling will be shaping the election?
I think it's the way that it makes the election more chaotic and harder for candidates to talk about what they want to talk about. That's for sure.
Well, you'll have a situation where Mitt Romney is trying to fashion a narrative, and then you'll have various super PACs with their own agendas fashioning a different narrative for him.
I don't know Brian Baker, who is running that super PAC for the Ricketts family, but my sense was, if nothing else, this was a move by Brian Baker to make himself the Jerome Corsi of 2012, whether it was good or bad for Romney or the Ricketts family.
Well, the Ricketts family has been feeling the pressure ever since. TD Ameritrade suddenly is a target of liberal groups that are saying they want to take their money out. Chicago Cubs fans are concerned, and the city of Chicago is reconsidering going into a new not a new stadium, but some
deal to help them.
Yeah. People don't realize. I don't know whether people boycott Georgia Pacific products because of the Koch brothers, but I'd imagine that there are some people who notice the companies that the big contributors to either party are connected to and might want to apply some pressure against them.
I think the Ricketts family will get more heat than the Kochs because the Kochs are so far back in the supply chain. I don't know if there's Koch brothers materials in Safeway or Fairway, but I certainly know.
Yes, so there
know.
Are Brawny and all sorts of toilet tissue and napkins.
When we get
Vanity Fair napkins.
When the names get out there, we'll know. And you put up more names than I'd thought of, and you're right then.
There are also the little moments that seem to reaffirm our perception of the candidate, and they often live on long after the campaign has ended. John Kerry ordering a Philly cheesesteak with Swiss cheese, the video of John Edwards doing something with his hair, Michael Dukakis in the tank, or George H.W. Bush's amazement at the scanner at a supermarket checkout. Do you think those are important in shaping voters' opinions and ultimately their vote?
They're what I'd like to call a common placeholder. Everybody might have a different reason for deciding Dukakis wasn't very good, but we all saw the tank. So if you're in a bar and you say, remember the tank, everybody will say, yeah. But if you say, remember when he said something about endives in Iowa, only one out of 20 will remember that statement. So you focus on the thing everybody saw, not when you really form the opinions.
Well, to some degree, those things confirm the narrative that is being formed about that person, not necessarily the narrative they want. John Kerry is an elitist who was French. That was the attack on him. John Edwards as a pretty boy. George H.W. Bush as a man who was totally out of touch with
the
common
folk. But if
we
hadn't already thought those things or suspected them or smelled them, it wouldn't have mattered. I'm not saying that having a common memory doesn't keep it alive longer, but it has to have a basis in what we smell and sense.
Where does the Willie Horton ad fit into that?
The Willie Horton ad is a devastating critique, frankly, of the Dukakis campaign. The Willie Horton, and this is not a defender of anything about the ad, but this was a huge issue in Massachusetts. Dukakis almost had a statewide referendum to overturn him until he agreed to sign a bill changing the furloughs. It was brought up without racial tones in the primary by Al Gore. To not be prepared for that is inexcusable.
So how important is it for campaigns to respond well to attacks and attack ads?
It's extremely important because when there's no response, people assume there is no response, that you're accepting
but
it.
But then you can sound defensive if you do have a response.
You have to be very careful to know what's on the public's mind, what the public is doing, and how to stay to your story. There are ways to say, you know, you have to be able to defend your record on crime in 1988, and he wasn't ready.
Or John Kerry, obviously had been a hero, and yet his campaign never seemed to respond well to the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth ads.
Yeah, I've never understood that one because John Kerry was a legitimate hero, and the men whose lives he saved with some incredible maneuvers campaigned with him against Bill Weld. And why they didn't pull out these guys or why Kerry didn't handle it is so it's examples of what happens when there's a cacophony and there's no unified coordination.
Many people complain about how long our presidential campaigns run, especially when you compare them to countries where the official campaign is limited by law. Do you think there's some value to making our eventual president go through the grueling and lengthy slog of 16 to 18 months of campaigning?
The campaigns are no shorter today than they were 100 years ago. The difference is they're more public longer because you're not courting 50 bosses and visiting them. You're courting thousands of reporters and Twitter followers. And you're doing it in public, not in private. It's more the activist and less the money and the bosses.
But that would make it even more difficult, I would think. Is this just simply a matter of having more stamina than the next person?
Well, you do need more stamina, but I don't think it's necessarily a bad test because look at the people who got weeded out from General MacArthur versus Eisenhower to Michelle Bachmann and Rick Perry, were pretty boys who had big followings and couldn't handle the distance and the gruel. I mean, it's not that the public is smarter than the bosses, but giving all the public time over and over to get at them, it shows eventually.
Well, there's less room for error. When Rick Perry entered the race, many people predicted that he was going to be the eventual candidate.
Yeah.
And then a number of faux pas, and the next thing you know, he has disappeared.
I was stunned by that.
By how incompetent he was?
How incompetent. I didn't know. It's either he's really dumb or he's so much like Rudy Giuliani, I'm God and I'm ready no matter what, that he didn't do any homework.
Well, you say that Hillary Clinton was hurt during the campaign for the Democratic nomination in 2008 by the fact that she used I so frequently, the word I.
Well,
did Obama say we all the time?
Hillary acted like she was already the nominee and here's where I'm going to lead the party and here's what we're going to do and when I get to there, I'm going to do this. Obama was reaching out and making himself somebody that people who supported the other candidates could find also acceptable when theirs dropped. And she ran as if the nomination was so secure that she wasn't going to do anything that would make her trouble against McCain later.
So was it a kind of presumption or a perceived arrogance that sunk her campaign?
I think it was a presumption and an inability to adapt to local primaries from running a national campaign.
There were also a lot of leaks from her campaign, and we see that always in troubled campaigns. We saw it with Newt Gingrich, for example. We didn't hear any problems in the Obama campaign. And earlier with Bill Clinton when he won the presidency, which was filmed, if you remember.
I was there very, very briefly in that film. And you didn't hear much with W's campaign in 2000. And in each case, the candidate had a group of people whose fame and fortune depended on getting to the promised land and then cashing in, not on getting big salaries along the way and promoting themselves.
My guest is Samuel L. Popkin. His book, The Candidate, What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House, it's published by Oxford University Press. We've mentioned some gaffes, but Mitt Romney's campaign seems to be pretty disciplined, and yet he is has created a number of negative headlines by things that he's ad-libbed or done at campaign events. Is it so early in the campaign that it won't really matter?
Nobody runs a perfect campaign any more than any golfer plays perfect four rounds or anybody plays anything perfect. There's so many things that happen. And that's why I stress how important it is that your team is ready to help you when you get knocked down or make a faux pas.
I mentioned during our introduction that you don't seem to think as much as other people do that events decide elections. Why do you think that isn't true?
Well, wait. What kind of events do you mean?
For example, I was thinking the market crash in September 2008 really hurt John McCain's
chances. I agree. I apologize. I will clarify how you react to those events. When I meant is campaign events, the little faux pas. The market event was John McCain's big chance to take back control, and he blew it beyond imagination.
It's been suggested that Barack Obama might have done well if he could have waited until September before they killed Osama bin Laden.
Yes and no. I think that it's a short effect, but whenever it happened, it takes away an attack on him for being weak and not getting anything done. The fact that he sent the extra helicopter, the fact that he took the chance when half of the others were worried about the doing it, you can't say he's not out there defending America hardcore.
He has said that the economic numbers will be what determines whether he's reelected. Is it really as simple as that? Because Ronald Reagan was an incumbent president. He won re-election with an unemployment rate that was considered rather high, above 7% at the time. The debt was triple what it is now.
I think the thing is that the economy is not one issue. We see that with the Tea Party yelling about the just entitlements of the older white voters who are afraid that their money will be frittered away for immigrants and poor and health care for people who don't have Medicare. You've got the concern about inflation, unemployment, interest rates, trade deficits. There's a lot of economics, and not thinking of it as an issue is misleading, I think.
What about confidence in government? That's changed a lot over the years, particularly in the Congress. Does that present an added challenge to a presidential candidate?
Yes. The wind is not in your back when you say the government's going to do something. You have in the age of ATM machines and choice and hundreds of channels, the big attack on anything the Democrats do by the Republicans is one size fits all.
And not just channels and such. I mean, you go back 60 years of winning and losing campaigns, but in most of those, there was no such thing as Twitter or Facebook or all the other internet sites that are out there. People weren't going to YouTube to see a candidate make some faux pas.
Well, I think I was asked recently, what is the first modern campaign? And I said, well, in some ways, I think of it as 48, because that was the year both candidates had organizations independent of the DNC and the RNC. So they were autonomous units. Every campaign has new media for either reaching voters.
Kennedy, Nixon was television.
And Eisenhower used television. He was really very important to him.
LBJ used it poorly, and that hurt him.
Well, I think
when
he
would
LBJ
give those speeches, my fellow Americans, and he looked so insincere, it didn't matter whether he was telling the truth or not.
Look, the Tet Offensive in the war killed LBJ, and it didn't matter if he sounded like Cary Grant or Gary Cooper.
So what do you look for in the current campaign? Are the major themes of the election and challenges that the candidates will have to overcome already in place?
How close will Mitt Romney be to Paul Ryan determines who wins.
You think Paul Ryan could sink his campaign?
The same way Taft sunk Dewey, and the same way that Gingrich and his rowdy freshmen, as George Stephanopoulos said, they became my new best friends, because every time the House freshman went crazy, something happened that made it harder for Bob Dole.
Just one other thing. You've also served as a consultant in other places, Canada and Europe. Do you give the same kind of advice?
No. In a parliamentary system, it's really about the party much more than it is in the United States. And that makes all the difference. When people think about shortening the campaign, well, the ideal thing then would be for the Senate Majority Leader to run against the Senate Minority Leader, have Harry Reid as the Democratic candidate.
Well, in some ways that's better, because the party that wins the most seats in the legislative body is the one that rules. In this country, we can easily imagine a situation where the candidate from one party wins and the Congress is controlled by the other party. We've had that many times. It's led to a lot of problems, too.
Not only do we have it, but it's one of the best friends of the incumbent president of the other party is to portray themselves as the only defender against the excesses.
Uh-huh. Or a do-nothing Congress, fighting against a do-nothing Congress.
Right.
Samuel L. Popkin is a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego, and he has served as a consultant to many political campaigns. And now he's written a book about it called The Candidate, What It Takes to Win and Hold the White House. It's published by Oxford University Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
A pleasure.